For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
So good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out on such a beautiful evening. Our teacher, Taigen Dan Layton, is on sabbatical right now, and he'll be on sabbatical until October, is that right? End of September. So a lot of us are filling in to give talks in his absence, and I really appreciate the chance to be able to give a talk, and also, again, thank you for coming tonight. Especially on such a beautiful night. It was like, today was one of those first days of spring where you open the door and you don't realize for the last 6 months how you've been clenching to like go outside, you know? And like, cause I did it today and I was like, oh, I've been doing that for 6 months. And like, I didn't even realize it, like just bracing myself. And I'm like, oh, it was so nice. And to hear all the birds singing, you know, like there are more and more of them. I was just 2 weeks ago, I was on a trip with my family to South Padre Island in Texas. It's usually a big spring break place, and there was a little bit of that there, but I was really blown away by, we went on a bird walk, something also I don't usually do. But I was like, oh, we'll go on a bird walk. And it was really fascinating because a lot of the birds come from South America and migrate up through there, and so it's a stopping point for them. And we had this really interesting guy. He was a naturalist. He was really laid back, but really intense about birds. So, you know, it was, you know, I guess that's a good thing to be. But it was really interesting because, like, I learned so much about birds, like, just going out and looking at them that I would never have known before. Like there's different kind. Like, there's a, I was able to watch this blue heron through binoculars that I'd never looked at one that close. It's so beautiful, like, and graceful. And it was sitting in a tree. I've never seen that before. And there was another kind of heron, a tricolored heron, that if you've ever seen a blue heron hunt, it like kind of like stays really still. This guy was like running all over the place, you know, and it had like almost like purplish feathers and green. The really surprising thing for me though was these shorebirds, which are not flashy. You've probably all seen like a sandpiper before. And I thought there was maybe like one kind of sandpiper, but there's not. There's a lot, because Javi, our guide, pointed them all out to us. And he, even though he knew so much about these birds, he would get really excited about them. He's like, oh, look at these two birds. They're a contrast between the lesser whatever sandpiper and the greater whatever. And like when you looked at them, you're like, oh yeah, there is a difference. But if I had just seen them, I would not have known the difference. And what was fascinating for me about these birds is these little guys are like this big, you know, they probably weigh a couple of pounds or whatever. They migrate from, you know, South America all the way up to Canada. They spend two months up in Canada, and then they migrate back down, and they keep doing that over and over again. And I'm just thinking, like, how does this little tiny bird do that? You know, they stop in South Padre Island for a little while, and then they store up food, and then they go up really, really high. And instead of going around the Gulf, they go over the water. So they have to get up really high to get these winds. I don't know, I was just really fascinated by all this. I went off on a tangent, but I also saw an alligator, which I wasn't expecting to see. I don't know. Anyway, so it was just really, oh, the other one, I saw this osprey, which is a seahawk, and they kind of hang out there in the winter, and we're sitting there watching the birds, and all of a sudden it lifts up from the water and it has a fish in its talons, and it just like it's flying around, and for like 10 minutes it was just flying around with this fish, and I was just like, when do you ever see like a fish, like a bird, like grabbing a fish out of the water, and just like, you know, anyway, it was fascinating. Bird walk. It was 2 hours, but I was like, wow, this is amazing. It kind of relates with what I'm going to talk to you tonight, but I'll get back to this bird stuff later. Last week, Douglas gave a talk on the Fukan Zazengi, kind of an introductory talk about this text of Dogen. Dogen is our 13th century founder from in Japan. And he wrote this right after he came back from China. You know, this was his first sort of text when he came back, and he revised it several times over his lifetime, so it was, you know, very important to him. So I'm not going to read the whole text or anything, but you can look over, you can read along if you'd like to. It's in your champ book. It's on page 20 in your champ book if you'd like to read along. I'm only going to look at really one paragraph, and actually I'm only going to really talk about two lines of this, but I thought I'd read this paragraph. The first paragraph kind of like introduces some of his key teachings, actually, that he expands on in the Shobogenzo. And then he gives some examples of some practitioners like the Buddha or Bodhidharma. And then this is the paragraph I'm going to focus on. So it's, therefore, put aside the intellectual practice of investigating words and chasing phrases, and learn to take the backward step that turns the light and shines it inward. Body and mind of themselves will drop away, and your original face will manifest. If you want to attain suchness, practice suchness immediately. Another translation of this is, if you want to attain just this, immediately practice just this. For practicing Zen, a quiet room is suitable. Eat and drink moderately. Put aside all involvements and suspend all affairs. Do not think good or bad. Do not judge true or false. And another translation says, do not think right or wrong. Another kind of like nuance to that. Give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Stop measuring with thoughts, ideas, and views. Have no designs on becoming a Buddha. How could that be limited to sitting or lying down? So I've been, reading this text for a little while. We've also had like a little, we have a Dogen discussion group called Dunkin' Dogen on every other Saturday. We've been looking at this text. And so I thought I'd share with you some of the things I've been practicing with. I kind of think of myself as like trying to explore some of these things, and I will often take like just one line and like work with it for a while, especially with things like from Dogen. But I'm not, I don't have it all figured out, so please forgive me. So the line that I was really interested in is, do not think good or bad, do not judge true or false, or do not think right or wrong. And I was thinking how that seems kind of impossible, a little bit, or at least, what is that? What does he mean by that? Don't judge good. Do not think good or bad. Don't think right or wrong. In Zazen, and in life, what does that mean? So this kind of good or bad, I think, is probably related to what are called the defilements in some Buddhist schools. I don't really like that word defilement because it sounds like it's dirty or something, although it is something that we kind of work with. It's what we chanted earlier when we chanted all my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. These are sort of the big delusions in Buddhism. And usually there's three objects to these. There's pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And usually we tend to want to desire what's pleasant, to have aversion to what's unpleasant and get rid of it, and to really just ignore what's neutral. So I was thinking about how this, do not think good or bad, how would that work with some of these things that are always arising? There's always something pleasant or unpleasant or neutral arising. So how does that work? I remember the book that I read from a Theravada monk from Burma, and it's called Don't Look Down on the Defilements, They'll Just Laugh at You. And he's a teacher of some people in California at Gil Fronsdahl's Sangha. His name is Sayada Utejaniya. I don't think I'm pronouncing that correctly, but here's what he says. And I thought, right attitude allows you to accept, acknowledge, and observe whatever is happening, whether pleasant or unpleasant, in a relaxed and alert way. You have to accept and watch both good and bad experiences. Every experience, whether good or bad, gives you a learning opportunity to notice whether the mind accepts things the way they are, or whether it likes, dislikes, reacts, or judges. Liking something means you desire it. Disliking something means you have an aversion to it. Desire and aversion are defilements that arise out of ignorance. Ignorance or delusion is a defilement too. So don't try to create anything. Trying to create something is greed. Do not reject what is happening. Rejecting what is happening is aversion. You're not trying to make things turn out the way you want them to happen. You're trying to know what is happening as it is. I think those last couple of lines of trying to create something, I find myself doing that a lot. And I'm or trying to make things turn out the way I want them to be. Or in Zazen, judging something as good and like, oh, I want it to be more like that. Like, oh, I wish that the rest, like the first 10 minutes of the sitting period were wonderful and the rest of them were pretty crappy. So that's bad. So, but then it's like, oh, you know, like, how do I work with that? I'm trying to create something that, you know, isn't there. I'm trying to make something happen the way I want it to happen. And so thinking about this, how these sort of things arise and how do you work with these? I read an article in the Buddha Dharma Quarterly by Larry Yang. He's another Vipassana teacher in California. And his article is called In the Moments of Non-Awakening. And he says, as Buddhists, we spend much of our time talking about awakening, about developing a compassionate heart and an enlightened mind, about freedom and liberation. While the centrality of those experiences can't be disputed, neither should they become an excuse for denying the reality of our situation right now. We give short shrift to the places where we get caught, where we're not inspired or really not living up to our vision of who we aspire to be. If we focus only on awakening, we miss most of the spiritual practice. I'm much more interested in how we practice with not awakening, with not being enlightened, because frankly, those states of being are more present in my life than not. Is the point of practice to negate or deny our very tender human experiences? Even if we're encouraged to go through them rather than go around them, the value is placed on the getting through rather than on being in and with. I really like that line of the very tender human experiences. And I think the other line that I wanted to highlight in this paragraph was Dogen's instructions of taking the backward step and turning the light that shines inward. I've been working with that line for a couple of years now, and it, like, every time I sit, it's like, oh, that's what that. It's just a really nice. It's very short, but it's very rich. There's a lot to work with there. I like this idea of taking a backward step because I think, as a person, I'm always like moving forward. You know, physically, I'm always trying to go forward, mentally, spiritually, professionally, always moving forward. And you know, it's like, what's next? What's next on my to-do list? What's next in the next hour, in the next day, in the rest of my life? And this taking the backward step, even it just is like a nice break in that pattern. It's sort of like lets that momentum of like, we're human beings, we're always moving forward. It's like, oh, let's take a step back. And that little step creates some space. I think inwardly, inside, it gives like a little space. And what's interesting, what I've been working with is when these things arise, like some desire or aversion, envy, all these kind of strong emotions. What's interesting that I've been working with is that taking that step back, in maybe ironically or paradoxically, actually allows me to be more intimate with whatever is arising at that moment. So it's like taking that step back, even though I'm not close to it anymore, I'm taking a step back, I'm able to really observe it and really be with that, whatever is arising in that moment. And I think this is a little bit, this is kind of this do not think good, do not think bad. It's like just observing it, just watching it as it arises. I was listening to the radio yesterday, and I heard this tail end of this story about the Juno probe that's going to Jupiter. And this, I only heard the last part of it, but apparently they're going to be able to make some kind of 3D map of the cloud layers or something and go in deeper and look at the core of Jupiter, which they know something about or not a lot about. And the scientist was like, he was just so, like, you could just see his curiosity brimming over. And he said, let me find what he said. Oops. He said, we've been studying Jupiter for centuries. You know, Galileo looked at Jupiter through a telescope. You know, we've sent probes there. But he said, every time we look at something in a new way, we find surprises. So even though we've been looking at Jupiter for centuries, this new way of looking at it is going to really reveal some surprises that we don't even know we know about Jupiter. And I kind of thought that's a little bit like sometimes when those really strong patterns and habits and emotions come through, it's kind of like this giant gas planet inside, you know, twirling and spinning, for me anyway, you know, just like feeling this like, oh. And so taking that backward step, you know, allows to be able to watch a little more closely and to have a little perspective. And maybe we need to take a couple of million kilometers back and look at it with a telescope to really look at it, sometimes not be that close. But it just feels like that backward step allows the surprises to happen, especially with the things like that I've been looking at for so long, you know, the things that keep coming back over and over. I've been watching it for maybe not centuries, but some of these things for my whole life. But maybe I can find something new without thinking this is bad, or it would be good if I was doing something else. That backward step allows me to see it in a new way. I see something surprising that I haven't seen before. And I think I've been thinking too about what is the light? Taking the backward step and shining the light inwardly. What is that light? I mean, some of it is maybe the light of awareness, just putting awareness on it. I think some of it too, I mean, is maybe that's like the scientist, the sense of curiosity, a sense of wonder of what's happening, even if it's really painful, like maybe like, I wonder, that sort of mind shift of being, Hogetsu gave a talk about inquiry a couple weeks ago. That's sort of like taking that step and like just changing the mindset of like, this is a, like, that little change of like curiosity changes the way we can look at something, or the way I can look at something. Another one of Dogen's famous sayings from the Genjo Koan is, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. And I always thought of this as a progression. Okay, first I'm going to study the self, then I'm going to forget the self, then I'm going to be actualized by all myriad things. Like, let's get past the study the self thing. Let's go on to forgetting the self. And I think this kind of goes back to what Larry Yang was saying, is like, studying the self is like really, this is where it's at, you know? This is where we're studying how these things arise, this is what's arising right now. This is, how do we react to things? How do we respond to other people? How do we respond to difficulties? And then maybe like this whole progression, maybe all this stuff is happening simultaneously all the time. That's a different talk probably, but I really wanted, like he said, give short shrift to studying the self. I wanted to kind of forget the self, because studying the self can be kind of icky, right? There's a lot of stuff I don't want to look at very closely. I don't want to experience really. But skipping that would be, as Larry Yang said, denying my very tender human experience. Another article that I've been working with as I've been thinking about this is from Zenju Earthlin Manuel. And it's called, What If Our Delusions Aren't a Barrier to Enlightenment? I'm just going to read a little part of it. If your inability to cut off ceaseless thought has ever left you feeling hopeless or inadequate, you're not alone. Anyone who has practiced earnestly for any length of time has likely wrestled with the thinking mind, motivated by a desire to evolve away from delusion and toward awakening or enlightenment. We may wonder what we're missing, always searching for the secret code we believe will unlock the door to enlightenment. But what if our deluded minds aren't a barrier to enlightenment at all? What if they are the very path to it? And the rest of her article, I recommend, it's a very good article that goes into more detail about this, about how she works with this. But that question, what if our deluded minds are the very path to enlightenment? So this thinking about how I don't want to think good or try not to think good or bad, just try to be with the, whatever's going on, all the icky, embarrassing, painful things that might arise, or even the wonderful, joyful things that arise that I would probably label as good, you know? How do I work with this? In the Tibetan teachings, there's a mind training teachings that called Lojong, and they're made up of these slogans, these very short slogans that you kind of, like we do with teaching stories here, you just take one and you like let it, you sit with it for a while and you carry it around with you in your mind as you come up through the day. You watch it as it arises in your day unexpectedly. And this slogan is called Three Objects, Three Poisons. So we talked about those, right? Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, three poisons, desire, aversion, ignorance. And then the third part of it sort of turns the usual way we think about this on its head. The last part is Three Seeds of Virtue. So it's saying, I think kind of revolutionary in a way, is that these three poisons, desire, aversion, ignorance, are actually seeds of virtue. They're places in our life where we can open to, that these are the places where we're stuck, but that stuck is where we can find awakening, or where we can find kindness, where we can find patience, where we can accept ourselves. For not being these awakened beings. So going back to the birds, we have this this teaching poem that Taigen likes to use, and one of the lines is, I follow the stream back to the source and wait for the time when clouds arise. So I've always appreciated that because it's very something I can see every day in my life, clouds. And like that's an instruction for Zazen, so just watching things come and go. And so I thought maybe another one could be like going out on like a bird watch or something where you don't know what birds are gonna show up. That the guide, Javi, he goes there every single day and leads these bird watches, and he was still like really interested to see which birds were gonna be there. So it's not like these birds here are good, these birds here are bad. It's like, what's happening right now? Are the shorebirds going to be there? You know, am I going to see the what was the one that he really was interested in? The yellow mangrove warbler. You know, he was he heard the sound and he really wanted to see it. And is it going to be something rare, or is it going to be something that's just passing through right now and then we'll leave for a while and then come back? And so I think I've been trying to play with this a little bit and say, like, okay, so when I'm really, like, you know, irritated with someone at work, like, is this kind of like, oh, let's just watch it like a shorebird, like, oh, this comes and goes, you know? And I think more than just like thinking of it like birds, I think it's like, how can I observe this? How can I be with this? How can I take that backward step and just study this with curiosity? And what are the textures of this in my body? Because I think this backward step is also a physical thing that we can do as well. It's not just the next part of the text that he has is really just like what you do with your body. You sit down on a cushion, you cross your legs, you rock your... And at first I thought this part was like kind of out of place. I was like, it doesn't seem like... And I kind of skip over it because it's like... But then I started to more read it and it's like, oh, this is like he's... There's all this stuff up here that he's talking about, but really it's like just about our bodies. And so where do these things arise in our bodies, in my body? So giving this space, the way I've been working with that work is, I'm a teacher, I teach second grade, and I had a really problem with some envy and some jealousy recently. I teach in this style called workshop model. It's a way of teaching, reading, and writing. And I've been doing it for a while. And there's some other teachers who are doing it, and they formed a cohort, and they're doing this thing district-wide. And they didn't ask me to join it with them. I mean, I didn't say I was interested, but you know, but still, I was like a little bit hurt and like a little envious of these people. They get to do all this stuff, you know? And so I decided to try to take the backward step. And, you know, it was kind of painful to watch. I think jealousy can be kind of not pleasant. And it can be make me feel a little ugly, you know, like, but I just sat with it for a while and watched it. And really what was interesting is underneath that envy was like, I want to do something like that. I want to create something like that. And then the more I sat with, like, you know what, I'm not really that interested in this workshop model. I would rather do something with, you know, makerspace or design thinking or stuff like that. And then another job position opened up that I took that is actually doing these things. So, I mean, not everything works out that way, but it was like, but what was really interesting for me was to see, like, okay, envy, you know, it's for growing up in a Christian household, it's like, that's bad, that's sin, right? Being jealous. But, like, instead of, like, pushing it away, and instead of, like, just giving into it, I just watched it. And it was really interesting to see how below that there was, like, this desire to create something new or to try something new that kind of came out of that. Another example from my work, again, is I teach second grade, and they're really into these things called Beyblades. Do you know what these are? They're these tops, and you click them in this little thing, and you spin it, and like you're trying to like either last longer than someone else, but if they collide with each other, like one of them will fall apart. Like it's made to fall apart, and then you put it back together. So if anyone who has been around kids knows, these things can be really annoying because like they fight with each other. It becomes this huge, all they can think about is like Beyblades or Pokemon or whatever it is. So they wanted to play it at recess. And my usual response is, no, we can't have toys in school. You know, ban it. But then the teacher who teaches next to me, she was like, well, why can't they play that? And I was like, yeah. So that was kind of like a little bit of taking a step back. And then it was like, well, we can't just let them play it because they're going to fight and it's going to be annoying. And then the recess people, that's not fair to them because they're going to have to deal with that. So then it was like, well, what kind of learning do we want them to do with this? And so I had a meeting with these like kids. There's like 12 of them. the next morning, and we figured out, okay, we can't do it here because they'll go over the fence. We can't do it here because people are walking. And they're like, what if we did it over here? I was like, yeah, what if we, and like, but the ground is too, is concrete-y, and it will ruin the top part of it. They don't spin as long. And so one of them was like, what about cardboard? It's like, yeah. So we got these cardboard boxes that have edges on them so they could do it. And then they came up with some rules, like, you know, be kind to each other, share, because like not everyone has one of these Beyblades, so it's kind of, you're leaving someone out. So they're like, oh, we should, if someone asks you to use it, you can share it. You should share it with them for one turn or something like that. Another one's like, no arguing, you know, but I mean, things like that. So what was really interesting is like that, even in daily life, just taking a step back and saying like, oh, I'm gonna be curious about this instead of saying, no, you know, I'm gonna be curious about this. What happened was is like everyone's having a good time. You know, the lunch people love it because like there's a group here and a group here and they're like kind of doing their own thing. And the kids really like were able to advocate for themselves. They are cooperating. I mean, they still have conflicts. I mean, these games are kind of made to have conflicts, but then they have to work through it, and that's also a positive thing. So this backward step, and I'm glad that that other teacher kind of put that in my head, like, yeah, why can't they? Like, that little curiosity allowed them to, you know, take some ownership over their own recess. That's all I have. If anyone has any comments or questions, rebuttals, disagreements, thank you.
How old are second graders?
They're 7 and 8.
Those sound like pretty advanced kids. I don't think I could have done that. Mm-hmm.
Well, I definitely help facilitate some of that, but yeah, I mean, it's what was amazing though is I thought this would last one day and then it would go back to Lord of the Flies, you know, like, but like they really want to do it, and so they're really following their guidelines that they made up, you know, so. And I think it's also interesting because, like, for some of them, it's like bringing something from that's fun into school, whereas like maybe a lot of the day isn't fun for them, and so like this is what they're really into. So yeah, so they're really intent on being able to do this because I think they know like if they don't follow those guidelines, we might have to like find another way or not be able to do it anymore. So. Oh, thank you.
I can really relate to envy and working with that. When I have a situation where I have to teach a particular 8-hour course with someone else, and we have this sort of a curriculum, and we, yeah, I've taught it with other people, and I teach it with this one person very frequently, and I like to teach with her because she's very good. She's really good. And it makes it so much easier and more enjoyable for me, except for the fact that we get evaluations. Like, everybody in the class has evaluations on us at the end. And I get really good evaluations, which is nice. And you would think that that would be nice. She gets great evaluations. Oh, yeah. And it always, in the beginning, it would really, really bother me. And I would have that whole thing of judging and you know, trying to push it away and trying to build myself up, and I would come up with some reason why I was better at her than her at X, but you know, and one day in studying that, I was able to just sort of let it be and just let it, you know, let it just fall down and just say, hey, you know what, this is hard for me, and it's not my best, strongest. And what's the shame in that? You know, mm-hmm. I get up here, it's challenging, I do it. why, you know, what was he like to just let that go? And and I found that that could really help in a lot of situations. It helps me appreciate, you know, the good in someone else that I don't have. Which is a lot of accepting what is, rather than you know, like we can do with our zazen, say, you know, well, I should be, you know, having no thoughts, and I should be, you know, in this place. That just isn't what's happening. Mm-hmm. So what if we were just to accept the way that things are, and that's it, and not be striving. Not that that's a strategy that we can apply to every single thing, but
right, yeah.
It allows for other possibilities to arise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what this has, a lot of this has shown me, like working with this shown me is like that, the possibilities that when you sort of like give it a little space, you know, like, oh, there's different ways I can respond to this, you know?
Stop throwing yourself at that one goal that you think, that your idea, and then just let them go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
That's like taking the step back that when you're too close to something, like when you're too close to the wall, all you can see is like the bit of the wall that's directly in front of you. And then you take the step back, maybe a few more steps back. And then you realize like, oh, like maybe there are a bunch of nice pictures hanging on the wall, right? And so you get a more complete view, and so you don't have to focus on just that bit that's an inch away from your face that you're obsessed with. Taking that step back maybe allows you to focus on the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
I was partial to the gas giant analogy. Sometimes I definitely feel that way. And like, not just when I eat too much cheese. But taking like the telescopic view of it, I think might end up being helpful for me.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, there's another line that I like too, that also made me think, from Guideposts, what is that called? Guideposts of Silent Illumination. And it's a line that's on the wall. There's a really nice little picture of it, of flowers by the tea kettle. And I always like to read that when we have all day sittings. It's sort of like, it's very uplifting, and it's silent and serene, forgetting words, bright clarity appears before you. When you reflect it, you become vast. Where you embody it, you are spiritually uplifted. Spiritually solitary and shining, inner illumination restores wonder. I just always like that. Inner illumination restores wonder. I think that's kind of what that shining the light, I think, comes, is for me anyway, that sort of like sense of wonder or curiosity, or which is really hard to do. The other day I was I woke up to sit meditation, and when I walked out, my wife had put these giant in our windows, these giant things like release the report, the Mueller report, and so sort of like the history is like, we used to live on the bottom floor of this apartment, and like we put lots of stuff in the windows like that. But then like there's all this junky looking tape and everything in there, you know, and we had to clean it off. And so then I was like, and then also on the second floor, we have this nice view with the trees. We're kind of in the tree line. And so it was like these, you know, giant letters going across. I was like, oh man, why did she put that up there? Like, with tape too, and whoa. And so then I had the chance to watch it when I was like, and I would like to say, oh yes, it was inner illumination restores wonder. It wasn't, it was like I was like, oh man, whoa, thinking all this stuff. But it helped me calm down a little bit. And I did mention it to her on my way out, but it was more of a, not a, why did you put that up there? Or it was more like, how long do you think we're going to have that sign in the window? And she's like, oh, just for a day. I was like, and then she said everything that I said. I was like, oh, okay. We went. So instead of me going in like, that little moment of, and I did not feel, even when I was saying it, like I was totally settled or anything, but it was still, I was able to respond at least in a little more positive way, I guess. I don't know.
what's the deal with
yeah
enjoying your life but also not chasing after like things that you want? I feel like we're supposed to do both of those things mm-hmm. at the same time, like mm-hmm. enjoy your life, you know, it's all here, and it's true, and it is, and I usually mm-hmm. do, you know, but also at the same time a big part of the teachings are to, you know, not be attached to what you think you want. So how do we enjoy our lives without being attached to what we think we want? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is like that, and that, like the very tender human experiences. I don't think like desire is a bad thing in and of itself. I don't think aversion, I mean, sometimes those can be positive things, like I desire to, you know, go to work in the morning, you know, that's a good thing, like I have aversion to poison, you know, I mean, that's probably a good thing. I think it's more like how maybe like we get caught up and like those things kind of sink their claws in us, and so then that limits us.
Like not getting pinned down.
Yeah, I think it's like letting those things sort of be like there, like, because again, like pushing that away, that's another form of aversion, but like letting it just arise and be there in that moment, but not being controlled by it. Mm-hmm. I don't claim to have figured that out myself, but that's sort of my...
I think you're onto it, because I think also when you're not constantly chasing after what you think you want, if you're enjoying what you have or being open to enjoying what's here, there's new things to discover, mm-hmm. you know? Like, if you always... It's like when the kid is like, always wants mac and cheese for dinner, it's like, at some point you've got to, you know, like, see all the other kinds of food there are mm-hmm. in the world, you know, and mm-hmm. how great they are. But, like, if you just... are so attached to mac and cheese, you'll never know.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
I mean, mac and cheese, like your idea of mac and cheese. Mac and cheese actually become, you know, it is, like every time you eat it, it's definitely different. Mm. And mac and cheese is the same.
Whoa.
Just that trace after that one time that was really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one time.
That one.
That's the one time you want to
chasing that.
You're gonna always measure, yeah.
The
that's real.
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone who didn't try mac and cheese until I was 19, and I've been making that for the last years. No, what I wanted to say, I've struggled oftentimes with this kind of like double vision that our practice sometimes encourages, despite its claim to transcending duality, like with good and bad and right and wrong. I understand that attaching labels to experience as it arises mm-hmm. misses the mark. But we live in a world where there are right actions and wrong actions, mm-hmm. and when there is good and there is bad, when you bring the ethical dimension into it, right? When you think of something like white supremacy or your attitude towards it, it seems hard to turn that poison into a throne of virtue. Mm-hmm. And I guess that, you know, sometimes I just get caught in that, or I've been practicing with the idea of holding those two ways of vision at the same time, of transcending labels, mm-hmm. but also having a moral mm-hmm. compass. And I connected, but also connected to this, something that kind of opened the door for me was a quote by an Indian philosopher who, on the subject of desire, said the problem is not desire. The problem is that your desires are so small.
Oh. Huh. Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure exactly how relevant this is, but I keep thinking about, while I was listening to your talk, I was thinking about, last night or night before last, I saw Queer Eye, season 3, episode parents had wonderful lives. Mm-hmm. My wife and I were just both transfixed by the way these five gay guys go into a town in Missouri, southern Missouri, and completely transform the life of a woman, you know. But they do it in such a selfless manner. I mean, you know, talk about forget the self, you know. They're all focused on what does she really, really need, you know. And I don't know. I just think I felt that watching the show was like a great meditation, you know. And some of the things you were saying kind of reminded me of that. Forget the self is, to study the self is to forget the self. Mm-hmm. We're studying her and forgetting himself. You know what I'm saying? Running with Jody. You know? But it was just an amazing transformation in her life and the life of people on earth. So I recommend it to you. It's on Netflix.
Yeah. It's a big show in my house. That's,
Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you for the time.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I was thinking, to go back to what you were saying, like, that's what we call, like, the harmony of difference and sameness, right? Sometimes it's, we're looking at sameness, and sometimes it's difference, and so, like, what is that harmony between the two? Because if you do just one, it's not enough. I was, and also, I don't know her name, there's a civil rights worker, a woman who just started, like, I think it was a Ku Klux Klan, have you heard this story? Maybe a Ku Klux Klan member who, like, was, like, trying to, I don't know what he was trying to do, but she just, like, called him and started talking with him and didn't try to change his views or anything, just listened to him. And then over a couple of years, like, just from listening, like, he could talk to her and she would just listen. He actually, you know, disavowed the Ku Klux Klan. And is no longer a white supremacist, you know, works for civil rights. And I don't know, that's something, like, first of all, really brave that she did. But also, like, that kind of idea of, like, how do you work with that? And maybe just listening sometimes to someone and, I don't know. It's difficult, I think, what you're saying, but... Well, I think that's all we have time for, so thank you very much. Thanks again.